me on the sheet, but I don't believe it.
Oh, good gosh. Yes.
Great.
So then, and then you have...
Good gosh.
All right, I am opening the meeting of the House Education Committee on September 18th, 2017. Thank you, everybody, for being here. I do want to make a note that Representative Doherty is at her motherland right now, but she will be back. So for now, I'll be interning chair. So we're going to adopt the committee rules. There weren't substantial changes, but I'll read them out loud for the committee. The following changes were identified in comparing the House Interim Committee rules to the 78th Legislative Assembly House Interim Committee rules. The rules indicate that meetings of the committee shall be recorded. Audio records shall be placed with the Oregon Archives. In place of recording for field trips, a written summary of the committee's activities may be prepared. However, a recording is required if a public hearing or work session is held. Like the 78th Legislative Assembly rules, committee rules may be amended, providing one-day notice to members. However, the Chief Clerk's Office shall also be notified along with the committee. Is there any questions on the non-substantial changes to committee rules? All right. So, all right. Should we do brief introductions of members?
Oh, yeah, so that was just the order of the day's agenda.
Okay. All right, let's open an organizational meeting. Let's do an adoption of interim committee rules. Looking for a motion to adopt the committee rules.
Chair Hernandez, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 18, 2017.
And we'll do a roll call vote.
Second.
Representative Wilson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 18th, 2017. Is there any discussion?
And there's a copy for everyone on their desk.
There should be a copy for everybody on their desk.
Yep.
Did you second that, Representative? So,
no.
Wrong rules, but. all right. Let's do a roll call.
I know. Representative
Abbott? I'm an enthusiastic aye.
Representative
McLean? Excuse. Representative Parrish? Excuse. Representative Sullivan?
Aye.
Representative Spreer? Excuse.
Representative
Vile? Aye. Vice Chair Wilson? Aye. Vice Chair Hernandez?
Aye.
Chair Doherty? Excuse. The motion passes and the rules are adopted. All right. Let's do committee introductions. So we'll have folks introduce themselves. We'll start to my left with Representative Sullivan. How was your summer? Introduce yourself.
It was fantastic. Had a great summer. Extremely busy in the district, but I have to say personally a highlight for me is my son getting married this summer. So it was couldn't have been a better summer. So thank you.
Rich Vile, House District 26, and I am bleary-eyed this morning because we delivered grapes to the Portland Public Schools at 4:30 before we came up.
I can't top that.
I know.
Representative Paul Evans, House District 20, West Salem, South Salem, Monmouth Independence. Happy to be here.
Carl Wilson, House District 3, Grants Pass. Thank you.
Representative Susan McLean, happy to be here. Looking forward to the updates. Thank you.
Representative Fernandez, House District 47, East Portland. And I had a lot of tacos this summer, so it's good. All right, let's close the organizational meeting. And we're open an informational hearing on ESSA by the Oregon Department of Education. And Dr. Salam Noor will be representing ODE. Would you prefer questions during the presentation or after? That way,
whatever works for the committee. We're flexible.
Great. Thank you.
And if it's a point that I'm going to touch on later, if you would indulge me, I will let you know that we'll touch on it later. All right. Good morning, Chair Hernandez, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction with the Oregon Department of Education. Welcome back. We're delighted to be here before you today to bring you some updates relative to the Oregon State Plan under ESSA, and also an update on the assessment work that we've been engaged in for the last year or so at the request of Chair Doherty. So the Oregon Plan is what we call it. We don't actually call it the ESSA Plan, and we're really purposeful in that, because this plan represents what we want to see happening in education in the state of Oregon, and it really represents the values, principles, beliefs, goals, and outcomes that we want to see achieved in schools throughout the state of Oregon. So by way of background, the Every Student Succeeds Act was signed by the President in December of 2015. We had an extensive public engagement process that culminated in 24 community forums where we went out and presented information, gathered feedback from stakeholders throughout the state of Oregon, and then we went back and said to Oregonians, this is what we heard you say, is this correct? And that information was integrated into our state plan that was submitted to the U.S. Department of Education on May 3rd. We were one of the first few states to actually submit the plan to the U.S. Department of Education. We received feedback shortly after that, and we were able to respond to the feedback within 2 weeks. That was the time frame we were actually given. We were notified on August 30th that our plan was approved without any substantive changes. We had some technical clarifications that we needed to do in the meantime, but we were not actually asked to make any substantive changes to our plan. And our plan was recognized for the stakeholder engagement work that we have done, and the clarity and the ambitious goals and outcomes that we have actually identified in our plan relative to student achievement and graduation rates. So we are really excited about that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, Salam, what did you hear in these public engagements? What can you sum that up for us?
Absolutely. Chair Hernandez, Representative Ayala, we heard very clearly that education is a priority for all Oregonians. We heard that education needs to be well-rounded. It needs to include the local context in terms of local priorities and needs of individual students within local context throughout the state. We heard a commitment to the quality of the education system that we wanted to ensure. We heard a clear commitment to equity and access, ensuring that all students had similar opportunities regardless of where they lived and where they went to school. We heard a desire for engaging the community in the learning process that students were engaged in. We heard clearly that education needed to be relevant, flexible, personalized, met the needs of the individual students based on their goals, based on their interests. We heard from educators that they want to be supported and they want to be actively involved in developing and shaping education plans that informed what happened in schools and classrooms. Hands-on learning was a theme that we heard repeatedly in every community. Students engaged with us in this process, and I personally met and interviewed with different students group throughout the state, and they all talked about wanting their education to be rigorous, quality, engaging, inclusive, provided opportunities for different type of learning experiences in school and out of school. So the themes are really consistent, and essentially they culminate in this notion of a well-rounded education that helped create a well-rounded individual that is well-prepared to move on after high school, whether they go directly to the workforce, they go to a college, a trade school, a training program. Those are the things that we consistently heard.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And so what was your conclusion at the end of this process in terms of determining the impediments to accomplishing these things? Why are they saying we need to do this and we're not there yet, in other words? Because that's what I'm hearing. We're not there yet. What do we have to do?
Representative Chair Hernandez, Representative Vial, I think I would answer that in the context of what we had and where we're going. So we actually saw lots of exemplar practices throughout the state relative to student engagement, relative to access to quality curriculum and a broad range of experiences that helped enhance learning. We saw really great models with supporting teachers in the form of professional development. We saw a rise in career and technical education programs in our state over the last 2 or 3 years that are facilitating those opportunities. So I think when you have these conversations, they're sort of open-ended, and it's hard to pin them down specifically to a particular practice or program. But what I will say is that we're coming off of the heels of No Child Left Behind. And No Child Left Behind has been implemented in our state for the last 15 years. So I think most participants were responding to the education system we've had, which has been really prescriptive for the last 15 years. It has narrowed the curriculum. There is an overemphasis on accountability, and we're not afraid of accountability, and everyone that we talk to supports accountability. But everything was out of balance, if you will. So the overemphasis on accountability narrowed the curriculum, narrowed the instruction and the opportunities that we afforded students. So we overemphasized math and reading. So schools saw their electives get sacrificed, if you will. They saw, I can tell you for a fact that there are some courses, some elective courses that were turned into what's called intervention courses in order to support students in math and English language arts. So I think the communities that we engaged with were sort of reimagining education the way they want it to be, but also they were reacting to the way education has been too narrowly defined over the last 15 years because of No Child Left Behind.
Dr. North, thank you. I really appreciate the candor in that answer. Thank you.
Absolutely. So if I may continue, Mr. Chair. So these are really the four pillars, if you will, of the Oregon plan. And it's and we believe that these are defining levers relative to education in the state of Oregon. And this is what we tried to emphasize, and that is this is the Oregon plan. This is not the plan. This is not the federal government's plan. And therefore, we want to leverage the resources and the opportunities that we have within ESSA to help inform the system that we have in the state of Oregon and develop the best education system we can afford and offer our students. So these four key principles are prioritize and advance equity. And this is really a central component of the Oregon plan, because the Every Student Succeeds Act is the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. And this law is a civil rights law. It's designed specifically to supplement the educational opportunities that states afford particular groups of students that have been historically underserved in our system. So equity is really an integral component of everything that this plan is intended for and represents. And that means actively initiating and leading conversations about equity, sharing data to identify disparities, being culturally responsive, proactively seeking support from parents, families, communities to meet the needs of all students. So that is something that is an integral part of this plan. The other is what I just referred to, which is extending the promise of a well-rounded education. And it's really interesting because the law, compared to No Child Left Behind, has three new words in it, and that is well-rounded education. And that should not be new to us as a state. It should not be new to education in general. But for some reason, we feel that we've been given permission to think more broadly about education rather than just accountability for reading and math. We need to have accountability for the learning that occurs in our schools, regardless of what subject students are engaged in, recognizing that we will measure their math and reading proficiency because these are critical skills that they need to have in order to be successful within K-12 and beyond. So the notion of a well-rounded education is really intended to support a rich learning environment in which all students can thrive, a safe learning environment, and a support and the supports that they need to be successful. And as I indicated earlier, the No Child Left Behind law overemphasize reading and math at the expense of other subjects. And I can tell you for a fact that we have many Title I elementary schools that don't really offer a comprehensive curriculum. The day is spent pretty much on reading intervention and support, math, and maybe a 30-minute blog for social studies, health, and everything else. And those students deserve to have access to a well-rounded, comprehensive curriculum that includes science and arts and music and health and PE and a variety, and social studies in particular. So,
Representative Springer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Salam, you talked about NCLB being the driver of the rigorous testing. What have we done, and if we haven't yet, what are we doing as a state to change? Because it is state testing that everybody talks about in the schools, not NCLB testing.
Yes.
So what changes have taken place, and how are we doing that in a way that doesn't make things easier or lower the bar?
Right, right. Chair Hernandez, Representative Springer, I will talk about assessment and what we're doing in the field of assessment in general shortly, if I may just defer that to later, and I promise to answer the question. But we are taking some steps to broaden our understanding of assessment, so it's not just testing, that testing is part of a balanced assessment system, and that we need to emphasize both what's happening in classrooms relative to assessment, formative assessment, an interim assessment system tied to the state assessment. So we're not relying exclusively on this test to tell us everything that we want to know or need to know about our students in the school. I promise to get to that. So just continuing, the other piece that's really critical that is a shift from No Child Left Behind to this new system, and that is strengthening district systems. In the past 15-plus years, we've identified schools that needed improvement, and the work was specifically with those schools. We did not actually engage the district relative to improving those schools. The work was specifically between the agency, the Department of Education, and the schools, because that's what the law required, that you provide the intervention and the supports to those schools. Under this plan, we will collaborate with districts to improve those schools. So we will work directly with school districts to build systems that will help improve those schools, and the rest of the schools in the school district can have the benefit of that work and the experience that that particular school is going through. And I think that has a much more sustainability component to it, because those practices can become normalized throughout the district instead of just focusing on that school. And also, you remove the stigma of that school being in need of improvement. That way, the district now is developing systems to help support all students in all schools. And the last component, and this is something we're really proud of, and I've had the opportunity to speak on this issue even at national conferences, is the ongoing engagement. So we started a process where local communities are engaged in conversations relative to education in their district. And that is something we want to continue to promote, with something that we feel is really integral to making sure that the plans truly represent what communities want, truly represent the students and the needs of those students in those communities. Under No Child Left Behind, those opportunities were minimized because it was a very clear formula, and we followed that formula. Under this plan, we're saying we have to develop new plans that you submit to the U.S. to the Oregon Department of Education, and community engagement, family engagement, parent engagement is an integral part of that.
Thank you. Dr. Noor, you had mentioned talking about strengthening district systems, and it's my understanding that Hillsborough School District is the only school district in the state of Oregon that has received accreditation and had gone through that process within the state. So when you're talking about strengthening the school systems, is there a push, is there an encouragement to have other school districts in Oregon look at that process? Because believe me, it is in depth. It is not just, you know, two people coming in and writing notes in a book. It's a real pull back the curtains look at a district and how they work. So I'm just wondering, is there more districts in Oregon that are looking at doing that as well, along with Hillsborough? Yeah,
absolutely, Chair Hernandez, Representative Solman. So I believe the accreditation that Hillsborough went through was through Advanced Ed, which is an external entity that comes in and accredits the high schools in particular. And high schools are required to be accredited because they're sending institutions to post-secondary colleges and universities. So I know that there are many high schools and many districts in the state that go through a similar process, and I think many of them go through Advanced Ed, perhaps not to the same degree as Hillsborough. So our continuous improvement planning process will have a similar requirement, and what we've done in the past is we said you have to use this system, and it was the state system. It's called INDISTAR. So we're changing that process, and we're giving districts the flexibility to choose whichever strategic planning process they want to go through, and to share that information with us, to report that to us. What we will do is have consistent questions and consistent indicators that we will use to determine whether the plan actually meets the requirements. But we would encourage all districts to go through a similar process. And I think our goal is to work with districts to differentiate the supports that we offer, so it's not a one-size-fits-all, and to help direct them towards such resources, and to be a partner with them actually in conducting some of these assessments, if you will. The planning process, regardless of what system you use, Advanced Ed, Baldrige, or whichever system you choose to use, has a needs assessment. So every school district will have to go through a needs assessment relative to the district in its entirety. And that's how we get at these improvement cycles, in terms of going through a consistent process that all districts follow, but the methodology will be flexible, of course. So, yes.
Is there a follow-up?
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Vile?
Out in the district, I hear these sort of common refrains, and it usually comes from a teacher, and it goes something like, all I want is two things: get the doggone state off my back and get me enough money so that I'm not worried about my job every year. If you're on an education committee, those are the only two things I want from you. I'm kind of encouraged, honestly, because what I'm hearing is that while you're taking the responsibility to make sure districts are successful very seriously, you really are looking at a change in direction that doesn't have as much state interference down at that very local level, and looks for supporting the local community in developing their own successful system. Have I correctly articulated that?
Yeah. Chair Hernandez, Representative Vial, you're absolutely correct. And I just want to underscore that this does not compromise our ability to maintain accountability in the system and to keep our focus on student outcomes, and especially meeting the needs of our historically underserved students to close the achievement gaps that we have in our system. But the goal is to differentiate supports, so it's not a one-size-fits-all, is to work collaboratively with districts to help them go through a process that meets their needs, and to really partner and shift our focus from exclusively a compliance regulatory agency to a partner and support agency. And I believe we've been making progress in that regard. And under the new plan, I think districts will see more evidence of that.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative.
I was going to wait because we're just interrupting your performance and in your presentation. I apologize. But with that last comment, I've got to make a connection with what you just said. First of all, you know, I taught for 42 years, so that last 15 years, you know, as you move into a focus or you move out of a focus, it takes years to get over, you know, what that particular focus did. And as you point out, math and reading became the focus. And so because of that, we lost tools in the toolbox. And so to your square, the square back where you're talking about fostering ongoing engagement, and you were talking about prioritizing and making sure that we had a well-rounded education, the districts have to go, you know, have to retool. Some of the tools they've got to bring back, like CTE, and we started that, you know, as we were going into this, you know, basically this transition. But there are still things going on. At the high school in Hillsboro, where I taught for 34 years, they dropped fourth year French, speech and debate, journalism and newspaper this year as we're going into this new transition. And those are all areas where you've got hands-on learning. You've got opportunity to be engaging, and you get to teach reading and math, but you get to do it with activities and with developed, you know, types of curriculum that are very unique, special, and interesting. And so we're going to have to retool to be able to bring about some of those issues after 15 years with this focus on math and reading. And so as Representative Vial and Representative Solomon were talking, it's not like it's going to be turn on the light, turn off the light. When you go from heavy, you know, accountability only very, very focused small curriculum areas, we've got to then blossom back out into that full picture of a well-rounded education with hands-on and accountability being programs, debates, presentations, performances as we go into some of these, you know, opportunities. So thank you for making it a very positive morning. But I think we need to understand that it's a process, and that as we get folks to process forward, we've got to make sure that we understand it's going to, we have to regroup.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. So I've touched on some of these components here, but if I were to describe what really constitutes our Oregon plan, I would say these three buckets, if you will, are the key components. And these are system levers. These are components that will help change practice, we believe, at the local level. They will help change the relationship between schools and communities and parents. It'll help change overall district practices relative to how they engage with their communities, how they support educators, and most importantly, how they use data to inform the work that they do with individual students every day. So these three categories, I mean, the plan is much bigger than this, if you will, but these three categories are really critical. So the report card redesign is a key element of the system, in my opinion, because this is the tool that districts use to communicate with parents. And the report card, if you recall, really reported on three areas. It reported on achievement, growth, and subgroup achievement, if you will, the individual groups within our system and their achievement and growth. This report card is intended to be a lot more inclusive, and we are looking at both academic and non-academic indicators, and the idea is to look at multiple measures of student success and school success. So instead of rating educators in schools exclusively based on the academic performance of students, we're looking at other indicators that are important to the academic achievement of students, such as absenteeism, the percentage of students that are actually absent from school, who's absent, why they're absent, growth for English learners, for example, growth in the academic areas, and I'll talk about those here in a bit. The balanced assessment system is about testing, if you will, but expanding the conversation, so we're not just talking about this test that we give at the end of the school year, and we use that test to determine how students are doing or how schools are doing. It's an important component of accountability. We need to have as many students participate in that assessment so we have comparable data from year to year, and it's really important for us to have that assessment to make sure that we are keeping track of the achievement gaps in our system and the progress we're making to close those achievement gaps. But when we talk about assessment, it's a balanced assessment system that includes formative assessments that teachers are conducting on a regular basis with students. We have interim assessments that a district can do in its entirety to determine how all students are doing relative to the curriculum and instruction that they provide. And then we have the summative assessment that we administer at the state level. But with the overemphasis on testing, the state test, we tend to forget about these other tools that many teachers tell us are more informative, more relevant, and more useful to support students. The school improvement component is that continuous school performance element that we discussed earlier, and it pertains specifically to schools that we will identify as in need of improvement, that are in need of improvement, and then district systems to support those schools over time. So I'm going to get into those in terms of a timeline really quickly with you, just to give you a sense of where we are, because we shifted to implementation right away before we were even approved by the U.S. Department of Education. So on the report card, we started the process of engaging stakeholders, different communities around the state, communities of color, communities that represent the different groups of students that we have in our system, our tribal communities, to get some information from parents specifically about the information that they want from schools relative to their child's education and what's happening in that school. So we started this process of stakeholder engagement, and the goal of the report card, just to give you a sense of where we're going with this, it will continue to have an extensive amount of information, but as we talk with parents often tell us, we want a high-level synopsis of what's actually happening in our schools and districts. So the idea is to provide at a glance report, which is like two or so pages, that provides the highlights, the key data elements that parents can grab and very quickly understand what's going on in that school and that district. And those reports will be available in multiple languages, of course. Then there is a more detailed report it's what we're calling a dashboard. So instead of just providing a paper report or high-level information, the dashboard will be able to take all of the components of the report card, and those include chronic absenteeism, English language arts and math achievement, English language arts and math growth, so we're looking at achievement and growth, English language progress and English language on track using our ELPA 21 assessment for English language learners, ninth grade on track, and that is the percentage of students that have 6 credits or more to graduate by the end of ninth grade, the four-year graduation rate and the fifth-year graduation rate, and then we're going to look at the completion rate as well. So all of those will be part of the report card, and as you can see, the report card will provide more information than we have in the past, and then we will have a dashboard that, instead of giving a single rating on each one of those components, it will show a continuum. So it will show whether the school is in the initial phase, in the intermediate phase, or the advanced phase. And then we will say it's making progress or about the same as we report from year to year. So we're excited about this, and the feedback that we're getting from both stakeholders and parents in general has been really positive. And this fall also will identify our preliminary schools. So under No Child Left Behind, we had, under the waiver and the waiver plan, we had identified focus and priority schools. Those categories are called something else under the Every Student Succeeds Act. They're called comprehensive support and improvement schools and targeted support and improvement schools. So the comprehensive support and improvement schools are identified based on this, the entire category that I just listed. The targeted support schools are identified based on a particular group of students that the school has not made progress with for quite some time. So we have the opportunity now to support Title I schools under comprehensive school improvement. However, the targeted school category is for all schools, not just Title I schools. So this really begins to give us a system of support for all schools in the state of Oregon. So comprehensive support schools are for Title I specifically. Targeted support schools are for any school in the state of Oregon. Now, if you're a high school, regardless whether you're a Title I school or not, and you have a graduation rate of 67% or below, you're automatically in that comprehensive support school category. So there is an overemphasis on improving outcomes and graduation, of course.
Two quick questions on the report card redesign. In your conversations with community and stakeholders, was there a discussion around having in the report card for the communities that this matters for, the representation of the staff and the students? For example, if my school district is very diverse, except my teaching staff is not very diverse. And I know that there are some studies that show a correlation between outcomes. Yeah. Was that a discussion or option?
Chair Hernandez, I think we've had conversations about a lot of other categories that we wanted to include.
Yeah.
And in the past, we reported on the qualifications of teachers in the school. I think this is a great idea. Let me check with staff and make sure that this has been part of the conversation. We will include the demographics of every school because that is something that we report on. But in terms of staff demographics, I will need to check and see, and we'll get back to you on that. But I know in the past we reported on the highly qualified, and unless Emily knows right off the top of her head, we will get back to you on that, absolutely.
At the end of fall or beginning of winter, we go through school improvement plans. And
yes.
One of my questions, which wasn't there before in my local school district, was to include that information for my colleagues.
Yeah.
And that was pretty useful, looking at every school and then also looking at the school district itself.
As a whole. Yeah.
But also information around social support services, mm-hmm. whether it's counselors, psychologists, restorative justice practitioners.
Yep.
The ratio of like how many per student.
Right.
It just gives you a big picture, you know,
yeah.
of one individual serving
right.
Hundreds and hundreds
right.
of kids.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's a great suggestion. Let me take it back and check with staff and see if we're planning to do that in this round of report card design or if this is something that was postponed for future years. The reason we postponed some of these collections for future years is because we don't have consistent and comparable data across all districts. So we're building this system as we go along. And as we identify data points like that, we want to be able to add them to the list and make sure that we're building systems both at the state level and that districts can also report on those. So
thank you.
Great suggestion. Thank you. So. Okay, I'm going to continue here, and this is just timeline information for you relative to these three big buckets that I shared. So by winter of 17-18, we will begin to finalize a prototype of this report card, and we will develop the RFP for the high school test. So to give you some quick information on the high school assessment, the Every Student Succeeds Act provided states some flexibility relative to the high school assessment. So we have the option to use something other than the Smarter Balance assessment that we currently administer in the state of Oregon. And for the first time, we have the option to adopt and implement an assessment that is nationally norm reference assessments such as ACT, SAT, and perhaps there are others out there. So we actually initiated the process called a request for information, and we did receive applications from both entities, ACT and the College Board. So we're taking that information and we're using it to develop a request for proposal that we will release in, I want to say winter. Yep, winter of 17-18 to solicit applications for the high school assessment. And the plan is to actually offer an assessment other than SBAC at the high school level. We still have to work with the State Board of Education and do the stakeholder engagement that we have done before relative to this topic. But the overwhelming feedback that we receive from schools and districts is that having an assessment other than SBAC at the high school level will be a lot more relevant, meaningful, value add for high school students and parents and communities. They also believe that it will serve as an equity opportunity for many students that don't have the resources to participate in an ACT or SAT college entrance exam, and that will increase participation in the state assessment. We have seen a drop in participation due to the opt-out law that we have in the state of Oregon, and we see a big drop actually at the high school level, and we tend to see it in our urban, more affluent high schools, and we know that many of those students opt for an SAT or ACT exam rather than SBAC because they don't see the relevance to their future next step, unfortunately. But as I said, we need that information to be able to measure our accountability progress relative to all students.
Yes.
Thank you for that. I got a request for a meeting from both of those groups, so I know you've been in conversation with them, or one and not the other, I don't know which. But the point that you made there that I think is so important is the fact that it's a dual purpose test, mm-hmm. and that we understand that we have to look at the quality of the test, and we have to look at the, you know, the indicators that help us with our report card. But I do encourage you to be really aggressive with that piece, because it feels like you're going to pick up a lot of support
yes.
from parents, school mm-hmm. districts, and really that you're going to help it not cost so much money mm-hmm. for folks mm-hmm. that need to do those types
right.
of testing for other purposes.
Yep. Chair Hernandez, Representative McLean, we agree with you. We are exploring that option, and we're moving very diligently in that direction. We have to make sure whatever assessment we choose meets all of the accommodations and all of the requirements that are clearly detailed in the Every Student Succeeds Act. And we have to make sure that this is a test that can actually meet the needs of all of our students. So we have not had extensive conversations with either one of those two vendors, specifically because we're going through a request for proposal process. So our engagement with them has been along providing information and soliciting information. So we're hoping that they and others will be able to demonstrate to us that whatever assessment we choose as a state is a quality assessment, it's a rigorous assessment, it meets all of the accommodations and access requirements, and also one that for the benefit of all students, has a reportable college score for all students and not just the ones that typically take it.
Right.
Just so everybody knows, we have around 15 more minutes, which includes the questions.
Do you want me to hold them to the end?
That would be great.
I'm already stacking two.
All right. Write them down. Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Go ahead.
So by spring of 2018, we will continue to build the report card, and hopefully by the spring of 2018, we would have gone through this process and identified that potential high school assessment for implementation in spring of 2019. It's going to take us about 18 months to stand up this system because we have to do some work at the state level, but we also have to allow for work at the local level so districts can also accommodate this new system. So by summer of 2018, we will formally identify our comprehensive school improvement supports and targeted school improvement supports. We will start working with districts in developing their improvement plans. Prior to that, we will provide some guidance relative to what we expect in those plans, timelines, and resources that we would make available to them. These are the accountability indicators that I mentioned earlier. I just wanted to show them to you. They fall into three categories: opportunity to learn, academic success, college and career readiness. And the whole intention behind broadening these categories is to facilitate a different conversation between schools and communities, schools and parents, relative to what's actually happening in that school. We focus on attendance and on track to graduate because we know that those are barriers. If students are not in school, they're going to fall behind and they're likely to drop out or not graduate in time. If students don't have 6 credits by the end of their 9th grade, they're likely to fall behind and struggle and potentially not graduate from high school or definitely not complete in 4 years. So we're trying to think systemically relative to those. What I want to add is that on the report card, we will actually have a 4th category. So it'll have those 3 categories, and the 4th one will be well-rounded education. And that is an opportunity for schools and districts to highlight some of the things that are specific to that school or things that are specific to their district that are different from other districts. And that was also designed to celebrate, showcase, and demonstrate some of the things that are happening within individual schools. And it could be the diversification of the workforce. It could be the student-to-counselor ratio. It could be the phenomenal career and technical education or STEM programs that they have, or the fact that every student has access to music instruction beginning in 3rd grade. So we wanted to keep it open to districts to share about well-rounded education, but we're using it as a lever to start those conversations. Fall of 2018, we will release a redesigned report card in October, and we will provide that formal identification of comprehensive and targeted support schools. So this is my presentation on the ESSA update. I have another presentation on assessment, and I don't know if that was part of the 15 minutes or not.
No, okay. That was not. That's a separate time. We'll start with Representative Solman and then Representative Spring.
Thank you, Chair Hernandez. So two questions. One, I'll start with the its assessment part of it. When you're talking about SAT and ACT testing and looking at, looking at what you're going to be doing in the high school, I really think that one of the things that we need to look at, there's a lot of conversation and even a lot of direction in our education about students going to college and always that college pathway. And that always seems to be a focus. And it's my belief that we need to start talking about more post-secondary, because the college pathway isn't necessarily something that every student wants to go to or, you know, will go to. There's the trade, there's trades, there's military, there's so much more, there's careers that I think that if you want people to really be buy into an assessment process, they have to kind of know what they're getting out of it. And if it's just always this college focus thing, they may not put all in, because that's just my opinion. Second one is, one of the things I think that is our need to be is there's so much information here, and I really feel like we need to have a stronger partnership with OSBA and our school boards, because those folks are the ones that are in your school districts as your representatives on the ground, listening to the reports from our school district saying, we're doing this right, we're doing this right. And if we don't give You know, some of our school board members are educators, and some are not. And if we don't give those school board members the proper tools and what they need to look for and what they need to ask for, I think we're missing a really big opportunity to have some oversight over the 197 school districts in our state. So I would just encourage that. So,
absolutely. Thank you.
Representative Spring.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Salam, you talked about the fourth category on the report card being that of a well-rounded education. And the first three categories are very quantifiable. Mm-hmm. It's very clean, clear data. How do you get clean, quantifiable data in a category called well-rounded education? And is that just going to be a feel-good section that we talk about things that we're doing, or are we going to talk about what we're doing and we're achieving something in what we're doing?
Mm-hmm. Chair Hernandez, Representative Springer, thank you for the question. And I think that is one of the challenges that we actually have relative to the report card in general, because we wanted, based on feedback that we receive from stakeholders and communities around the state, we wanted to include a number of other indicators, but we don't have data that we collect or data that is reliable enough to actually compare one district or one school to another. So this is it's an evolution in our development of what could be ultimately that report card. And right now, we are identifying categories that could be consistent across all schools and districts. We're not certain what those are yet. Community engagement was one, or parent engagement was another, because some schools and districts do a phenomenal job with engaging parents and communities in the process. But we really don't collect that data, and we don't have a consistent mechanism for measuring the fidelity of that data. So over time, we will be able to identify those categories and perhaps start collecting data. We don't want to burden districts, though, with additional data collections that are not directly tied to instruction. So part of our work also is to do exactly what you suggested. Which one of those indicators is directly tied to improving instruction and improving outcomes? So right now, it's an opportunity for districts to highlight some of the practices that they have for their community, but I think over time we can evolve it to specific categories and specific data points that we can collect without overburdening the schools and districts in the process. We have to be mindful of that. We're also doing some work for the first time to really define what we mean by well-rounded education. So we're defining that relative to the student, relative to the teacher, and the community. And from that, we would be able to glean specific measurable points over time. But again, I want to be really careful here to not suggest that we're going to start a whole new collection, data collection process that becomes burdensome for schools and districts. And we just want to move very thoughtfully and carefully down that path.
Well, thank you. That kind of answered my question.
Okay.
It sounds like it's a feel-good category when we talk about what we're doing. It wasn't that many years ago. It was a few years back, but not that many years ago. I was in a school building, a building that I particularly love, and the comment was made by a staff member, very appropriately so, very smart staff member. She was doing her job. And it was, make sure you put down in that book all your volunteer time, because that bumps us up on the report card. So that was a very telling statement. Mm-hmm. How many volunteer hours are recorded in a book we can debate this, but has no direct tie to student achievement,
right,
or the quality of a school? Just feels good being there, which is great, mm-hmm, but that does not mean that translates to student achievement. So when we talk about report cards, I become very concerned with things like that, and then nobody wants a well-rounded education more than anybody on this dais. However, what does that really mean? So I want to make sure, as we talk about another new way, that we're not losing sight of students graduating with an education that prepares them for secondary whatever.
Chair Hernandez, Representative Springer, and I would say members of the committee in general, I really appreciate your comments and appreciate the thoughtfulness and the intentionality behind our words and actions. What I would say as a conclusion to this presentation is that the opportunity that we have is one of a cultural shift in our schools and districts and communities. And it's a leadership opportunity for all of us in the state, not just us at the state level, but for local leaders, both educators and community members, to engage in a conversation about education. So under No Child Left Behind, our system was federalized. It looked like every other system in the country. Everything was prescribed. Everything was very succinctly defined. You had to go through this process, and if you didn't do this, then the consequences were very clearly laid out. Under the Every Student Succeeds Act, there is still guardrails for accountability, and we're still expected to deliver on results for all students, and particularly groups of students that have been historically underserved, and we have not met their needs in our system. But education is becoming more localized. I think this is the opportunity that we have for education to be more localized. One of the things that we take into consideration relative to the report card and the school improvement process and the district improvement process is local context. And in order to incorporate local context into your planning, you have to talk to your community. This is the part that we've overemphasized again and again. You've got to engage the community. The community was not, in fact, when I worked in the district, we felt that our engagement opportunities with the community were really limited because everything was clearly defined for us. The boxes were very well laid out. I would suggest that we need to think not just outside the box, is to think that there is no box here and to really give communities the opportunity to engage in developing their improvement plans, district plans that they submit to us, and we're expanding these categories so they're not so prescriptive, and we're going to look at results, of course, ultimately, but we're basically saying you have an opportunity to develop an education plan that meets your needs, and in order to do that, we have to rethink the way we think about education. We have to look very closely at who our students are. We have to look very closely at our workforce to determine how we're meeting the needs of those students, and we have to change the way we approach learning and assessment. So I think the opportunity is there for us to really engage in a process that's a lot more meaningful than what we have done in the past.
Senator Parrish?
Thank you. I'm going to try to figure out how to say this. And, we saw, of course, over the weekend, you know, newspaper articles taking a hit on testing and test scores and op-eds and, yep, you know, families opting out. And, this summer in between signee dying and coming back to legislative days, you know, we got the score for the 11th grade test at our house. And because those come in after school was out. And, what was interesting to me receiving that as a parent, I was actually kind of surprised that we thought that it would be bad in English and writing. We actually did okay there, and it was, the math was like 2 points above where you needed to be for the base assessment. And my concern is that when you get that score, if you're the parent, what's the plan on the school side to, you know, when you're taking that test in 11th grade, to say, okay, there's clearly a deficiency happening here. How do you then use that in their last year of school to make sure that they are getting caught up to grade level so that they don't need remediation in college and they're not having to pay for those classes and that tuition cost that comes with sort of our inability to get kids where they really need to be so that they walk into a community college or a four-year college and have that data. And then if we're letting families just opt out randomly, how do you understand where a child really is at all? And so I continue to sort of have concerns about testing, because I actually think we should be testing kids. And maybe not to the nightmare that it's been in the last 15 years, but and then how do you use that data to actually make informed decisions about an individual child's curriculum so that they can be proficient, that they don't need the remediation, because that comes with a huge burden and cost, and particularly for low-income kids who can't, you know, don't have mom and dad who are going to write a check for those math 40 classes in community college. I'm concerned that we do these tests and we're not using the data in a way that actually makes sense for kids in terms of moving them forward in their achievement. And so how are we going to deal with that?
Chair Hernandez, Representative Parrish, I believe the continuous improvement process that we have at the state level calls on districts to clarify to us how they intend to address students that are not meeting the assessment. That's part of the continuous improvement process. I can tell you that many districts use that information. Unfortunately, they don't get it until the beginning of the school year, and we are trying to figure out how we get that information to them in a more timely fashion so they can see it and act on it, or at least begin their planning before the school year ends. But many districts actually use that information to identify students that are struggling. They actually have plans for individual students, and sometimes it's in the form of looking at the coursework that the student is engaged in, offering some remediation, if you will, intervention courses and support courses for that students to make sure that they are making the progress that they need to. Because the SBAC score gives them a range of 1 to 4. Mm-hmm. And if you're a 3 or a 4, then you're fine. But if you're a 1 or 2, it's evident that you need some additional supports. So we, our goal is to create a process through which districts can identify those students, begin an intervention program with them in the senior year, and do everything they possibly can to make sure that that student is prepared to move on to that next step in their life. I can't tell you specifically what each school or district does. I can tell you from my own experience, we looked at that data very closely and we identified students, and I would walk into schools in my district here and we would know who those students were. And we would assign them to a teacher or a group of teachers. We looked at their schedule to make sure that they were in the appropriate classes, to make sure that they were on track to graduate. So there are strategies that schools and districts use, and those vary, I would say, from place to place, based on the student group, based on the community, based on the population that they are trying to serve, and based on their resources. So it's something that we need to continue to build on and expand on so these things become systematized. But this is really where the process of school improvement is shifting. So it's not just in that school that we do that. It's at the district level. We want districts to develop systems to support students in this regard.
We have a few. We're a little bit over already.
So 11th grade feels too late.
Yes.
Right. I mean, at that point, when you said earlier in your you know presentation, you know, kids who don't by ninth grade and then they're missing some credits. I mean, if they're not hitting those benchmarks in 11th grade, and schools don't get it really till the fall. I mean, they get it, the answers in the summer, and they've already slotted all those kids in their senior year. How do you yank kids out of required courses to do that remediation? That feels too late. Is there something in the federal law that says it has to be 11th grade? And if not, why aren't we running these kids through some sort of preliminary test in ninth grade so that we're not losing those credits in ninth grade, so that we understand how we need to build a customized learning over that four-year period? Because, like I said, when I got this, over the summer, it felt a little late. Now, fortunately, it worked out that he walked in on the first day of school and graduated and didn't have to go back to his senior year. But he only squeaked it by the 2 points on the math. And had he stayed, there would have been no real plan to actually finish him for his senior year. And so I worry about these kiddos who the parents get this information and maybe they're not tracking because, you don't have school teacher counselor conferences, in high school. And you're shocked because it has that score is going to have a correlation on grades, is going to have a correlation on college entrance. And that's the part I'm really struggling with.
Yeah. Chair Hernandez, Representative Parrish, totally agree with you. We have a lot of flexibility as to when we actually administer the test. It could be in 10th grade. The question then is the instruction. Have students had enough instruction to be able to perform well on the test? And that's why we actually moved the assessment from 10th grade to 11th grade to allow more room for instruction. But part of the conversation for us and the things we're looking at is what diagnostics tools can be available to schools and districts to support their assessment of where the student is, so we're not waiting until the test at the end of the year. And we're looking actually at the high school assessment and some of the recommendations that we received is to move it to 10th grade. But we have to look very carefully at that to make sure that students have had the opportunity to learn the content mm-hmm. before we actually test them in 10th grade. So that is one of the things we're looking at.
Thank you, Dr. Kumar. Representative Evans.
Thank you. A couple of things here, and again, the purpose of an interim committee hopefully is to learn more about what you're doing and to provide a little bit of input as you're moving forward. So here we go. Number one, it's the 70th anniversary today of the United States Air Force. I say that because my experience in the military, and perhaps yours in the Navy as well, is that no inspection-ready unit ever did terribly well in combat, and no good combat unit could pass an inspection to save their life. And the reason I emphasize that is sometimes the protocols and processes for inspections, for assessments, for designing the perfect widget don't tell the tale of actual capacity. And what I want to emphasize is this. Money is never the only measure of success, and quite frankly, we have put some investments into education recently, and I'm proud of that. But if you look at where Oregon started having problems, I don't think it's a coincidence that about Measure 5 period, about 1990 to 1997, when we started pulling money out and changing the relationship between school districts and the state, we tried to build a bicycle as we were riding it. So here's the deal. I believe that some of the basics are still important. Smaller class sizes, teachers empowered with the ability to teach, the tools to teach, a general standardization, which you're trying to do, that understands that kids aren't a thing, they're a person, and there is no scientific method to actually make a person something exactly replicated. And the last point is to make it simple. I believe that a lot of the communities, the people in the communities that want their children to do well in schools, are so confused by the educational complex of how to measure this, that, or the other, that they don't know what's going on, except that they know we're not getting the kids what they need. So please, for the love of God, simplicity. Here's my point. The community colleges right now, one in particular, cannot even get the GPA of students from the high schools as they come into their college. That's a system you would think, since we have the entire enterprise before us, we could make that information available. But for some reason, and I'm sure there's a law or a policy or somebody's interpretation, a community college, for a student that's coming into the community college, everybody's signed off, can't even find out the GPA, not the SBAC score, not their background, not anything else. So please, help make sure simplicity is not forgotten in our attempt to build the perfect system. That's all.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hernandez. So I wanted to say, too, that I very much appreciate what Rep. Evans just said, and also want to make us understand that students want a purpose. So if they're as they're exploring their pathways and figuring out what they want to do, if you want them to buy into this assessment, we have to be providing those options for our students, because it has to be, you know, we talk about well-rounded. I get that, and that is an important part of making sure we have a full education system. But it should be about our pathways. It shouldn't just be because these students are trying to figure that out. And so if they don't find that that's not my pathway, so I don't care about that assessment, you know. I appreciate what Rep. Parrish said about things being a little bit too late on that spectrum. We're having a manufacturing day that's coming up, National Manufacturing Day, that we're supposed to inspire students to get into the line of manufacturing. But it's for juniors and seniors. I'm sorry, if they haven't found their inspiration to get into manufacturing, it's too late. We need to be talking to 7th and 8th graders about that. And so I just feel like we get into this whole college focus, and this assessment is for a state thing, or this assessment is for colleges to see where you're at, where my son went the trade route. And so we just need to make sure that those trades want to know that these kids are at rigor, you know, have a rigorous education too, and that they're prepared. So it's trying to get that message to those students, is saying these things that we're teaching you have direct impact to your future. And it's so that's
amen to both my colleagues. Yes.
Thank you for the comment, Representative Solomon. I'm going to close the informational hearing, unless there's any.
All right. Thank you.
I want to open an informational hearing on the Oregon Department of Education assessment.
All right. Chair Hernandez, members of the committee, I just want to say we fully agree with you and heed your advice and direction in that regard, and that's really our goal. It may not sound oversimplified when I talk about it, but we are working really hard to simplify things.
I believe you are.
So we talked about assessment, and I totally agree that this is not just about college. This is the conversation that we're trying to change. So it's not about testing. In fact, when most people talk to me about testing or start a conversation with me about testing, I say, well, I really don't want to talk about testing. I want to talk about learning. Let's talk about learning, because when we talk about learning, I see students in front of me. And when I see students, I think about the learning that they're engaged in. Then as a teacher, I can start thinking about, what am I teaching? Is it meeting their needs? And then I can start thinking about, so what do I need to use to measure their progress? And are they all the same? They're individual human beings. They have goals, aspirations, hopes, and dreams. Their families have goals, aspirations, and hopes and dreams for them. And in some instances, we don't know what those are. So we can't assume that they're all going to go to college. But we want to make sure that that is an option that they're aware of. And it is absolutely about pathways that personalize the learning experience for every individual student and allows us to meet them where they are and take them to where they want to go, not necessarily to where we want them to go. And as a father of four children, it's something I've dealt with for a long time, and I can personally relate to that, where I want my children to go down this path, but they have their own ideas, and I have to
support it.
Embrace that eventually, ultimately, I did. But, and that's important. My second son is 25 years old, struggled in high school, found his himself and his passion in a community college, and just graduated from Western Oregon University this last summer. After having gone to Chemeketa and OSU, and he's a firefighter. I mean, he has a degree, but what he really wants to do is fight fires and he's on the CHETCO fire right now, and that's what he wants to do. He thrives on that. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but he does. So they're different. All four of them are very, very different from each other. So these slides are not simple, and I want to apologize for that. They're very wordy, and we touched on some of these things. So I'm going to go through this very, very quickly. The reason we're looking at different opportunities within the state assessment system is because we can. In the past, we couldn't. But the Every Student Succeeds Act gives us some flexibility in terms of how we approach assessments at the state level, and especially at the high school level. So what we hear from schools throughout the state is that the assessment is too long. It takes many, many hours for a student to complete the assessment. The assessment may not be developmentally appropriate for some students who don't have the technical skills or the technology skills or don't have the language skills to actually participate in the assessment. The assessment doesn't seem to be relevant simply because teachers get that information too late. They got it in September, so it's too late to actually act on it, especially with the students that they have at the time. And that the assessment doesn't add a lot of value to the student or the family, especially the high school assessment. So we listened to all of that, and these were part of the conversations that we had in our community forum. So we have taken some steps to pursue the flexibility at the high school level. So one of the things that we're doing two things. One is streamlining the assessment grades 3 through 8. So the SBAC assessment is truly the best test that's available that measures students' performance on the Common Core State Standards in English Language Arts and Mathematics. So it is truly the best assessment available, but we understand that it has some challenges with it, and one of those key challenges is the length of time for the assessment. So for this year, we are shortening the test without compromising the fidelity or the integrity of the test. So it will still be a sound, comparable, reliable assessment, but it will be shorter. And you can hear cheers in your schools and districts relative to that. They're very happy about that. We're also looking at the different options for the high school assessment. This will also help us achieve some cost savings that we were directed to achieve by the legislature. And it will be in the sum of $1.5 to $1.7 million biannually. So those savings are not new cost savings. Those have been taken out of our budget already. We just have to achieve them. So through shortening the test, we will be able to do that, and we will be able to satisfy the feedback that we got from the field. Okay. On the high school side, there is a dilemma, because if we were to shift to an ACT or SAT, there is an increase in cost. And we will work with those vendors to negotiate and get the best deal possible, but there is an increase in cost, because now it's a single contract with that vendor instead of being part of a consortium of many districts that are contributing to the cost of assessment. So we do anticipate an increase in cost to the sum of $3 million biannually. We issued the request for information. We did get a lot of information from ACT and College Board. We reviewed that information at length in great detail. We have a report. We are using that information to help us develop the RFP that we will be issuing later this fall. Okay. This is a breakdown on the cost. I won't bore you with a lot of the details, but it will show you the projected cost for 17-19, the amount we were asked to cut out of our budget, and then the additional cost that will be required to implement an SAT or ACT type assessment. And in speaking with Representative Doherty, she wanted me to make sure that I put this in front of you so you see that there is an added cost associated with this. The benefit is that students will get something that they can represent, that they can present to a post-secondary institution, or at least begins to change their mindset relative to their academic achievement and success. And in many cases, and we heard this from students that said to us, you know, I know kids in my class that are not taking the ACT or the SAT because they can't afford it. Or we know that we have kids that are not taking it because they don't think they're smart enough to take it, or they're good enough to take it. So providing this opportunity is really an equity strategy for us as a state, and it levels the playing field. Everybody gets to participate. Schools get data on students, and then they can act on this data. So
point clarification. So once we move into this new process, students won't have to pay for taking the test?
Chair Hernandez, that is correct. Yep.
Thank you.
Yep. So these are the key requirements for a state assessment. It has to be aligned to the content standards of math and English language arts. It has to meet all of the accessibility of all Oregon's high school students, including students with disabilities and English learners. So we want to make sure that this test, although is value add and expands the opportunities for students, is not inadvertently discriminating against certain groups of students. And cultural bias is definitely a component of that. And we want a college reportable result for all students. So students that we have to provide accommodations for and they take the test under this system, we also want them to have a college reportable score. So these are key features that we will not compromise on. Okay. This is the timeline. I alluded to this earlier. September 2017, we hope to have an RFP, at least a draft RFP, developed with stakeholder input. October, we will go through the procurement process with DAS and DOJ, release the RFP, review responses, and determine selection. So the timeline is between now and spring of 2019 for implementation. Students will take the SBAC test in this spring, and the first time of implementation of a new test will happen in the spring of 2019. So that is our assessment update. If I may add one more thing, I just want to keep putting this in the broader context of balanced assessments: formative, interim, and summative. And that's really the direction that we are headed, and that's what we engage schools and districts on regularly, is to say, let's help you develop formative and interim assessments. We would love to get some resources to develop a statewide system of formative and interim assessment, but we understand the challenges associated with that. But in terms of practice, that's what we're promoting relative to learning, and learning requires regular ongoing assessments of where the student is relative to the content. And we want those formative and interim assessment to be in all subject areas, not just in reading and math, because that is something that teachers do really well, and it provides them immediate information on the student, and it allows them to target and tailor support specific to that student. Thank you.
Representative McClain.
The one element about that last comment that you just made was that I know it was said within the framework of understanding that those other forms of assessment are really personal to the teacher, the curriculum, and also the students that are in that class. And also the comment that you made that it should be an individualized program,
yes,
per student, and that we should be relating to that student where they are right then.
Right.
And we want to try to make sure that they've got what they need at whatever level they're at any time during that first through 12th grade,
yes,
experience. So, statewide assessment building versus teacher assessment building, I think we have to make sure we've got a balance there, because the closer you are to the student, the closer you are to understanding where that student is, specifically that day, that year, or that month. And so I just don't want us to continue to believe, as Representative Evans, I think, was pointing out in some of the comments that he made, that, it has to be personalized with the people in the room.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So there can be guidelines and pillars for them to follow, mm-hmm, but they need to be able to be creative, they need to be able to be proactive, and they need to see the kid in their line of sight.
Right. Absolutely. Thank you, Representative McClain.
Representative Vile?
I was on exactly the same page as what Representative McClain was just saying. When you said, I wish we had the money to set up a statewide program to get these first two, mm-hmm, testing ideals sort of normalized across the system, I cringed, because that goes back against the grain of what we were talking about before. And the one size fits all, I think, would be a real big mistake for, if you're looking for a formative process, you need an individualized process by district. And Representative Hernandez's district is not anywhere close to Sherwood School District. Those are just two completely different districts, and trying to fit the same shoe on both those feet, I think, would be a mistake.
Yeah. If I may, Chair Hernandez, members of the committee, appreciate your comments, and I totally agree. I think our plan would be is to just build capacity in schools and districts to do this work, provide a platform, if you will, or a framework to do training, consistent training throughout. And I totally agree. I always believe that there needs to be a balance between what the state does and what happens locally. We have a responsibility to train, provide professional development, build capacity. But in the area of assessment in particular, and this is my own personal opinion, when you put a formative or an interim assessment into the context of a statewide assessment or a statewide framework, in essence developed by the state, you risk that taking on an accountability element. And that's not the intent here behind it. So I totally agree with you and appreciate your comments. And our role would be is to provide training, provide support, provide tools and resources, but allow those systems to evolve locally, but according to a consensus set of criteria or guidance. So, thank you.
Any additional questions before I close the hearing? All right, I'll close the informational hearing. Thank you, Dr. Knorr.
Thank you very much.
We're going to open an informational hearing on protocols relating to graduation ceremonies in Oregon. And this presentation is by Emily Nazaroff.
Chair Hernandez, Vice Chair Wilson, members of the committee, my name is Emily Nazaroff, and I'm a legislative coordinator with the Department of Education. And I was asked to provide just some quick information on the state law in Oregon with respect to graduation ceremonies and a student that is receiving special education services. So under state law, both state statute and administrative rule, all students have the option of participating in the graduation ceremony with their peers. If a student's IEP team, which includes the student's parents, determines that an alternative arrangement is appropriate, then an alternative arrangement can be made. If ODE receives a question from a district about a student's participation in a graduation ceremony, ODE staff would advise that the district that the student has the right under state law to participate with their peers in the graduation ceremony, but that an IEP team may consider whether an accommodation is in the best interest of the students.
Yes, Vice Chair Wilson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Chair Doherty scheduled this at my request. We had a rather large public controversy, which took over the front page of the newspaper a couple of times in my district, and I know some of you were made aware of that controversy. Kind of impossible to know exactly what happened. There were disputes on both sides as to what was said and what was requested and so forth. So I requested of the chair to have a presentation like this today, just so we would really know what the protocol is. As it turned out, there was a special ceremony put on for this autistic student, and huge public turnout, probably 750 people turned out for that special ceremony for him. A lot of hard feelings, I think, but I think both parties at the end, the district and the parents, said, hey, let's just do something. And so they wound up with the aforementioned solution, which was pretty popular. It really was. So I wanted to know what the protocol actually was, so thank you.
Is there any questions? Thank you, Vice Chair Wilson.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the informational hearing and open an informational hearing on the impact of class size on student achievement. Teresa Ferrer, representing ODE, and also Lori Wilmer.
Oh,
Oregon Education, of course. OEA.
A little different, right?
A little. All right. Didn't hit the gavel.
Good morning. Good morning. Chair Hernandez, Vice Chair Wilson, and committee members, thank you so much for having me here today. My name is Teresa Ferrer, and I am a teacher, and I am also a professional practice consultant with the Oregon Education Association and the Center for Great Public Schools. My colleague, Lori Wimmer, is with me today as sort of as a support, but also to help with questions after my testimony regarding specifics in QEM or anything else that you might have questions about. But I'm so happy to be here today, and on behalf of the 45,000 members of OEA who teach in pre-K-12 community college classrooms all around Oregon and represent our students and have them at our focus, I'm so happy to be able to talk about this topic. I'm a licensed teacher with 20 years experience. My whole professional career has been here in Oregon, in Oregon classrooms, and almost 18 years in addition to that in the Center for Great Public Schools at OEA. And as an OEA consultant, I work with members to elevate their practice and their voice in their profession. And that voice and that practice is there to deliver the ambitious promise of our profession and of our classrooms and for our students. Our center does many, many things. Part of what we do is elevate quality professional practice on authentic student assessment. We work on equitable and effective instruction. We work on reflective professional development that our teachers need, licensing literacy, and so much more. So I'm very honored to be able to work with OEA, but also with my fellow teachers in the work that we do in our profession. As an Oregon licensed teacher, from my experience, my assignments range from elementary, self-contained, special education, bilingual mentor teacher, to creating and coordinating a talented and gifted program. I served for almost 6 years as a licensed teacher representative in the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And while I was working for TSBC, almost the entire 6 years I chaired the Program Approval Committee, which really worked on setting the standards and looking at the accreditation of all of our teacher prep programs. So I have a lot invested in the profession, not only as a practitioner, as a teacher that works directly with kids on the ground, but also in setting the standards for our profession, which is very near and dear to my heart. When I started teaching in Oregon in 1979, a long time ago, I was the first teacher in my very small but wonderful district, Sayula District in Florence, a teacher of color in that district. And 10 years later, the population of that district looked more like me than it looked like most of my other colleagues. I am now working through OEA in a very special committee that many of you are familiar with, the Oregon Equity Educator Committee, in which we're trying to diversify the educator force in Oregon. It's very important work. But as a teacher, I tried always to encourage and look for youth that had the skill and the passion and the heart to become educators. It's a difficult career, but one that folks go into for very, very strong reasons. And as a teacher, I also was in charge of very small classrooms. When I was a tag teacher, I had classrooms of 10 students. And then it ranged all the way to very large classrooms when I taught in the Salem School District of up to 30 students in a 4-5 blended classroom. And if any of you are teachers, you know what that looks like to teach in a blended classroom. Not easy, with 30 or more students. Mm-hmm. And as a teacher, I've almost never had aides. And when I did have an aide, I usually did not have them for a whole day. Or if I had them for a whole day, they were usually assigned to one or more specific students with difficulties. So I really didn't have the kind of assistance that I needed to really get to all the students that I needed. So that was very rare. I give you this context because my goal today is to speak to you about the class size issue as a teacher from the ground, with students. And to let you know that in Oregon schools, we care about the health and learning of students, as all teachers do, and the promise of public schools, and especially the viability of the profession that I love. This committee and most Oregon legislators have visited this issue before. You've seen and talked about class size and its effect on student achievement in great detail with, and you set through House Bill 2928, the class size task force in motion, and it made recommendations that you considered. There were three very important recommendations, one of which gave you endorsements on class size and school populations, and that followed the Oregon's quality education model. They gave you very specific numbers, and those were guidelines, not necessarily mandates, but things to consider, all based on really good, sound research. And it bears some revisiting. I'll do it very, very quickly. In elementary school, they recommended around 340 students for the school, class size average of about 20 for grades K through 1, class size average of about 23 for grades 2 through 3, and class size average of 24 for grades 4 to 5. In middle school, about 500 students with class size average of 22 with a max of 29 in core classes. In high school, 1,000 students, class size average of 21 with a maximum of 29 in core classes. But more important than those very specific numbers were two very strong recommendations by the committee, and one was a commitment and a requirement to fund education to a level needed to promote quality schools, classrooms, and learning. That's a really important concept that I know that you all believe in. And then the third one was to create long-term solutions for quality education funding. And it seems to me that those two last two recommendations, if those were the foundation, that the very specific on-the-ground solutions to class size could be as unique as the schools or the classrooms or the students that you're looking at a local level. However, class size and all other school improvement issues need to be grounded in comprehensive approaches to what we know strong schools and robust learning looks like. We need to stop putting Band-Aids on what is not working and begin building what does work. You can toss around arguments pitting class size against quality teaching, but we all know that a good teacher can grow into a great teacher with a smaller class. We can focus our efforts on restorative discipline practices, chronic absenteeism, or nurturing culturally responsive practices, chronic absenteeism, or any of the other issues that we know that will help us with learning. But we know that smaller classes have dramatic positive effect on classroom management and attendance, while marginalized students benefit the most. The ability to create the learning environment in which students can flourish rather than flounder exists to a much greater degree in a smaller classroom. Pretty simple concept there. Student safety, security, creativity, engagement, love of learning, and ability to remediate or grow are all enhanced in a smaller classroom. the teacher-student connections, which we all know is the holy grail of teaching, and effective practice can be realized in a smaller classroom. Teaching practices have the time and space and all of the other synthesis, analysis, and skill-building environment that teachers need to grow as well. Teachers love smaller class sizes, not because it means less work, but because the hard work that they do can be more effective for more kids. Teachers stay in the profession if they know that they're making a difference. We all know great teachers who have left the profession or that have are less fulfilled in the work that they do because of all the huge challenges, class size among them, that they face. The very profession of teaching is in danger if we continue to work in conditions that the profession and the professionals know are ineffective and harmful to students. The medical profession, if we look at that, sets standards for the field of medicine and the practice of their clinicians, and those standards form the foundation of what hospitals and emergency rooms and the resources that outfit them look like. So if we look at Finland, which has made teaching into an advanced art and science, they treat classrooms as professional learning labs. That's a good lesson for us to be sort of looking at. The goal is not only to provide the best educational experience for their students, which they do, but it's also to advance the abilities of the professional teachers in charge of that learning. Finland averages 21 or less in a classroom, and it funds their schools to quality standards articulated by the profession. So all that to say is that we need to be focusing on the quality standards of learning, and smaller class sizes is something that 29 or I think close to 29 states have looked at. It's something that research says works, that students, teachers, and parents all want for their students. The research in our country on this issue is striking, so it's not a surprise that even though all of those folks consistently point to class size, politicians and economists are now taking note. Research by the U.S. Department of Education as late as 2001 analyzed student achievement data across 2,561 schools nationwide and found that controlling for student background, the only objective factor positively correlated to student achievement, is class size. Also, it was found that class size reduction is one of the few education reforms that significantly narrows the achievement gap between racial and economic groups. That's huge, and that's something that I know that you care about and you look at all the time. Earlier research ventures so far as to positively correlate class size in the early grades to better test scores, better grades, fewer discipline referrals, better graduation rates, and increased likelihood of going to college and owning a home. I have submitted additional information. You see a policy brief that I submitted to you from the National Education Association on class size. I also just recently sent something to you that you could look at that really looks at the research more explicitly. But there's a quote from one of those pieces that came out of June of last year, 2016, that I think is really significant that I'd love to be able to quote. It's from an article from the ETS Research Report Series, and it's titled Mind the Gap, 20 Years of Progress and Retrenchment in School Funding and Achievement Gaps. And it quotes, ample research has indicated that children in smaller classes achieve better outcomes, both academic and otherwise, and that class size reduction can be an effective strategy for closing racially or economically based achievement gaps. Although it is certainly plausible that other uses of the same money might be equally or even more effective, there is little evidence to support this. Smaller class sizes and reduced total student loads are relevant working conditions simultaneously influencing student recruitment and retention. That is, providing smaller classes may partly offset the need for higher wages or recruiting or retaining teachers. The author's analysis shows that with lower teacher-student staffing ratios in higher poverty districts tend to have lower than expected achievement gaps. There's so much other research, but it's recent. We've had some very rigorous research that was done earlier in the 1980s that has been looked at again and been replicated. So I think you could take a look at some of that as well. And finally, I'd like to end with this. Should the Oregon legislature enact policies to encourage small class sizes, we would not be the first state to do so. There are others that are doing it. There are some that have done it well, some not so well. So it's our hope that we would learn from the best and the worst. There are many local school districts and teacher associations that have mutually agreed on how to treat class size. And while there are no panaceas that solve all the learning problems, these class size reduction initiatives reflect a commitment to thoughtfully place students in the center of every decision. They also allow each local district and its teachers to consider its local context for any school improvement effort. Our resolve for fully funding schools should be at the heart of any solution we attempt, and our efforts must be grounded in quality standards for optimal learning. Class size is a foundational factor in all of the standards that we know about good teaching. It's a quality factor in all the standards we know about good schools. We cannot fail in Oregon to do what it takes to build the schools and the classrooms our students deserve. Oregon can and should do better in delivering that promise. Thank you, and I stand ready to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Stringer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that information. So I've looked at your brief on class size research, and you start by mentioning the STAR study, which is kind of the stalwart over the last few years, done in the late 80s. And it's a well-respected study, and I've looked at it in different venues. What that research cannot talk about, because it was in the 80s,
right,
is the use of technology. And I started to make a smart remark about technology in the 80s, but I won't. So technology is a very real part of the classroom at this point. And unfortunately, in some classrooms, it isn't still, because the teacher, understandably, is just hesitant to go there. I know some amazing teachers, one of which I'm thinking of, she hates technology. Got to get there. So what I don't see in your brief is mention of technology. I don't think anybody will argue a bigger class is better. I think we need to move from the paradigm of is it small or is it big. Nobody's going to argue a large classroom is good. However, there are mitigating circumstances, and technology is one of them, which I don't see mentioned here in the research you've cited. So talk to us a little bit about that and how that impacts class size.
Chair Hernandez, Representative Spring, that's a wonderful question. You know, technology has really created a new layout for classrooms and learning as we know it. And there are terrific uses of technology and not so terrific uses of technology. You can use technology in a way with bad educational practice that does not help a student to learn. And in many cases, it's the teacher's ability to see where a student is and how they're progressing and assist them is something that cannot be done with the technology. So that personal piece is really important in whatever kind of venue, whether it's online or using computerized learning. You're going to need to have that sort of connection to the learner and the progress of their learning to make it be really effective. So I think it does change the landscape, and I think I have seen some research, and I'll find it and send it to the committee as soon as I can retrieve it again, that takes a look at that. Not specifically in terms of policy with class size, but relative to the learning and what we know about what technology can do to create better learning. And I think that that's going to be important when we consider any class size initiative is what is it that we're looking for, and it's the learning that we're looking for, optimizing the learning in schools. And as you say, many classrooms don't use technology at all.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative
Vile. I'm fascinated by this discussion. I don't know if you saw the article in the Oregonian this morning about the McMinnville School District.
Did not.
McMinnville is a very diverse district, a lot of Latino particularly. Absolutely blew everybody else away in terms of their scores. report. I did a little research after I read the article. McMinnville's got a 25 average student class size. I'm just struck by the fact that Representative Springer is absolutely right. Anybody that would argue in favor of bigger classes is a dummy. And I don't want to be a dummy.
What I said? I didn't use the word dummy. Just qualify that.
She's called me a dummy before, so I, you know.
Uh-oh. And what kind of assessment did you use for that?
Yeah, exactly. A bit subjective, but Sherwood, for example, has got 29 students per class average. Mm-hmm. I wish we didn't have 29 students per class average, but we're doing well, frankly, with that 29 per class average. Mm-hmm. Reynolds is at 25. Why is Reynolds doing so much differently than McMinnville? And I'm just struck by the idea that we are got limited resources. We're doing everything we can to try and make sure that our funding model is fair and consistent and stable. And all of that's very important, but I have to say, I'm not convinced. I also read your brief, and I'm not convinced by the studies. I'm thinking that we've maybe got to look at some new data on what makes a difference in these schools. And if we simply decide that it's class size that's going to do the trick, I'm not convinced of it. Now, that's a very rhetorical way to put it to you, and I apologize for that. And if you have a response, I'm interested in hearing it. But honestly, this has been one of my most frustrating committees as a new legislator for the fact that we don't seem to be coming up with the solutions. And when I look at somebody like McMinnville that's saying, let's just get the best teachers we can, give them all the tools we can possibly give them, and let them as individuals treat individual kids as individuals, that seems to be working the best. I'm convinced of that. So, again, I apologize for the rhetorical nature of what really isn't a question, but I'm certainly interested in your observations.
So, Chair Hernandez and Representative Vial, I see Lori scooting up, so I am sure that maybe she has a few words to say. But I would like to say I have right in front of me the state report on class size, and McMinnville does have 25 medium class size, but they also have 119 classes with 15 students or less. So my answer to your rhetorical question would be, or my comment to your rhetorical question might be, I don't believe class size in and of itself is the solution. Class size is a foundational piece across all the standards, but you have to have a comprehensive approach to what rigorous learning in classrooms look like. And class size is a foundational piece, and then you have to have other layered pieces on top of that. And I think that that's so you could look at school districts that have similar class size and have very different results, but you need to look at what they're doing in addition to class size. And we the profession of teaching, we know what good teaching is, and so to see if those schools are employing and using strong instructional practice, and the schools have schedules that optimize learning instead of interrupting learning, and all of the other things, supportive services that students need. If those schools are employing those standards along with class size, with a similar school with the same class size, I'm going to tell you which school is going to do well. So those are the kinds of approaches. Now, Lori, I know you've read the article and probably have some comments as well.
Mr. Chair and Representative Vial, the only thing I would add to that is that both are true, in that if you have the ability to have that connection, that relational learning opportunity with individual students, because you're not in a crowd control situation, you have a meaningful class size that enables you to practice your practice to its best effect, no matter where the students come from, what their challenges might be to learning.
Can you introduce yourself?
For the record, Lori Wimmer, Oregon Education Association. You will be able to use those skills in a more effective way. And I think what McMinnville's results show is proof in the pudding of that exact way. They have small class size. They've used the best practices for addressing their students' needs, and the result is fairly straightforward. And where that has not been possible for any number of reasons, because the class sizes aren't optimal, it just makes the job more like an impossibility in some cases.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Both
of you, Teresa and Lori, I really appreciate the work that you do and the qualifications that you have and mostly the care that you have about kids. But I am going to say one more time, I'm not convinced that continuing as a state to try and direct the districts around our state on how to do their job is the right way to go. McMinnville's a perfect example. Yes, they've got some small classes. They've also got some very big classes. What they did is, as a district, mm-hmm. they looked and figured out, where do we need fewer kids in a class? Where do we need, or mm-hmm. where can we get the same job done with a bunch of kids in a class? And they deployed their resources in a very smart way, and the proof's in the pudding. And I'm just basically advocating for the idea that let's give these districts and some really good folks in those districts some tools to help them figure out locally how to get it done. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you want to comment?
Yes, Representative Chair Hernandez and Representative Vial, I agree totally. I think that the very best districts that I have personally seen do this have done this collaboratively with their teachers. And when you have that kind of collaborative vision from everyone in the school district, including parents and community and school mm-hmm. board members, everyone really focused on the student and where you've got to get the biggest bang for your buck, that's when you can make some real progress. And so any way that we can create the environment for that kind of collaborative work that really does do justice to the on-the-ground solutions for students, the better off we will be.
And if I were king for a day, would be looking at every...
Oh, boy. I'm shaking.
That's shaking up. I would be looking at every district administrator and saying, is this one capable of doing that kind of job or not? And if not, get rid of them and get an administrator or an executive in every district that really can make their district work by collaborating with the teachers. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. King for a day.
Super. And I get to follow up on that, don't I?
I don't think that will ever happen, but... Representative Solomon?
Thank you. I want to say that I really sincerely appreciate your comment saying that class size is definitely a factor in this big puzzle that we're looking at. I'm a mom of teachers. I can now say I have a son that is a special education teacher, second year teacher. He had a fantastic year last year, really manageable classes. This year he came in second day and was like, I have 42 kids in my classroom, all on an individual education plan, working with them, and his second year teacher. His wife, my daughter-in-law, third year teacher, has 29 students in her fifth grade classroom. And again, when you're talking about just the class size, but that partnering it with the fact that she no longer has a mentor, that program has gone away, and you're talking about students that are at different levels of education. And I appreciate that you brought up the part about the medical field, because I've used this analogy a lot. When back in the day when we established and we had doctors, and doctors would come and be your only person that you would ever see when you go to the doctor's office, is gone. Now the doctors say, my caseload is so large, I need to focus on where I can, but I need nurse practitioners, and I need nurses with certain certifications. So they've brought that into the mix as well. So I think it's really important that we understand that it truly does take a village. We have our educators, we have our teaching assistants, our classroom assistants, our folks that work with our students in with the individual education plans. And I think that that's important for us to look at, because that's an aspect of that. I also have a friend that's a seasoned teacher. I don't even know how many years she's been at Tobias Elementary, but recently seeing that her caseload is 32. And she's like, oh my goodness, the needs. Because we're not just talking about Johnny's at this level of math and Susie's at this level. We're talking about students that have trauma in their life. So we're looking at how we address trauma-informed care. We're looking at behavioral issues, because perhaps some of that could be with trauma. Some of that just could be something that's not, how do we address behavior in a positive way? We're looking at kids that have food insecurities. They don't know where they're getting their next meals, or housing insecurities. So you have 32 students in that classroom that are of varying issues and needs. And then we look at the other side of that, where at the school district in Hillsborough, I can use this as an example as an 8-year former Hillsborough school board member, where this year they had to cut $7 million from their budget again. So since 2008, they've cut $75 million from their school budget. And I say that, and I get that same reaction no matter where I go, because people are like, oh my, you know, these are students, these are kids. And so in a district where they say, we need to know every student by name, strength, and need, that's difficult when you have 32 kids in a classroom. Mm-hmm. That's just a fact. It's a piece to that puzzle that we need to look at and need to figure out how we address. I do agree that technology does add a layer to that, but you cannot replace technology with relationship. Mm-hmm. And when you have the ability to have it, we all can think back at those teachers that made a difference in our lives and where, you know, but it's important that we have teachers that are making connections with our students too. And when your caseload is huge, that's difficult. It is difficult when we look at state level things and assessments, because you can't compare a Riverdale, who had amazing test scores because most of their students all took SATs and whatnot, to other students in other districts that you know didn't match up with that. So it's a puzzle. And when we're all coming together and we need to look at all those pieces of the puzzles and we need to figure out how we support these kids and their families and the pathways that they take, that's what I think is key. So I appreciate you saying that is a factor. It's not the answer. It's not the golden ticket. But it is something that is an important piece of that puzzle that we need to look at and figuring out. So
thank you for the comments, Representative Solman. Did you want to respond?
Yes. Chair Hernandez, Representative Solman. Wraparound services is really critical to making any teacher in any classroom, regardless of the size, effective. And we have more of a need, I'm sure all of you know this, now than we have in many, many years. Part of it is a result of the recession that we went through, but we're definitely showing all kinds of need for services for students that have a direct tie into some traumatic things that have happened in their home life or conditions that they have to deal with. We also have a need for assistance, because you're right, it's a village that helps a classroom teacher, and that includes volunteers from the community. The problem with teaching assistants, not the problem with, but one of the challenges that we have with teaching assistants is that they come at a cost for school districts. And oftentimes they're not full-time, they're part-time, and if they're not full-time, they don't have the ability to have the time with the teacher to actually plan and assess and reflect on what the students need for that day, that week, that month. And so they're there. They're quickly given an assignment for what to do, and it's not the best way to optimize learning in a classroom. So if we really want to have a nurse practitioner model in our schools, we have have to actually build professionalism into the assistants that we work in the schools. So that professionalism does not exist now, and it should. Our students deserve it, and that's a wonderful use of adults to help build that village to serve students. There are so many ways that we could optimize learning, and we all know what they are, but we don't have the ability to do it. And so if we concentrate on what we know works and work to create as much as possible an environment that optimizes as many factors as possible. Class size is important, because even if you had tons of money to add some of the other components that we're talking about, and you still have class sizes of 30 plus, you're still not going, your ability to get the gains that you want, especially for marginalized students, is not going to occur. So class size is critical, but you need to add other pieces to it. But all of those things count. Thank you.
Representative McLean?
I could talk about this, as we all can, for hours, and I'll try to keep it to 1 minute or less. But I think that both speakers, as well as the studies that were quoted today, have acknowledged the fact that class size numbers are different at different levels of ages of students, and also, it's different depending on the curriculum. But I think the acknowledgement has to be made on the fact that choices, like Representative Vial pointed out, choices are being made, and sometimes at the quality of the education or the curriculum that's being offered. Because, for example, we understand that safety is different in different classes of 25 to 42 kids. We understand that even with technology, that there's a different type and different levels of supervision when you've got technology and students in your classroom. And we understand that absenteeism happens because those relational issues are occurring, because we have the larger classes, more students, and the kids say, I'm not going to get a minute of her time, I'm just staying home. So it's the acknowledgement that the actual issue of class size does make a difference, even though there are categorical issues to deal with. But another area that came up in the comments that you made that is important to me, that hasn't been said, and that is every teacher believes, and everybody else in the community seems to believe, if she's a good teacher, if she's an excellent teacher, she can teach anybody and any size of class. Well, you betcha, I could teach 42 kids speech and debate, but they're going to get less debate, they're going to get less speech, they're going to get less curriculum, and they're going to get less of my time. So it's the quality of that education. She can do it, he can do it. You can be that excellent teacher and know how to relate to those kids, but what are you giving them and what are you offering them? So I'm passionate. 42 years of my life went into this very thing. And there's a lot of standards and things that we need to look at. And remember the choice of that principal. I agree. The principal needs to make choices. I have a daughter-in-law who is now in her second year of being a principal, but she only has so many staff members. She's being told she has to take every one of her students through a test element. So there will be things that are dropped. No social studies, no health, no PE, no music. And at the high school level, and I've given you this already today, no fourth year French, no speech class, no debate class. So you make quality issue choices when you choose to drop classes, to drop in just certain areas of curriculum. So I don't know. There's no easy way or we would have answered it. Right. And one final thing. If you're going to look at data, make sure you look at if it's apples and apples or apples and oranges. The 80s study on this very subject had 21 kids in their classroom, and they said that was a big class. So let's make sure that we're looking at apples and apples and not apples and oranges. Mm-hmm. So let's keep talking. I'm passionate. Good speech, you folks. Thank you.
She judged you on your speech.
Chair Hernandez, Representative McLean, you touched upon a point, and you're right, we didn't talk about the fact that there's this, I don't know if it's urban myth or just a myth, a universal myth, that good teachers can teach anything, including an auditorium of 400 people. So, and that's a myth. you could stand up in front and you could give quality lectures. You could do those kinds of things. But the thing that we are faced with now is we have a growing number of educators that are retiring mm-hmm. who have put a lot of work into their practice. And when I say that, it's not just so that they're exhibiting something. Mm-hmm. It's that they know that they are moving learning of kids. And they know it. They know what it looks like. They know how to do it. All the nuances are figured out. And they have seen their ability to do that go down and down and down and down year after year after year. And then we have all these new educators coming in who are still trying to build those skills and really do not have the learning labs to do it. They don't have, for many of them, an opportunity to really understand and build those skills to bring about learning. We can lecture, we can put learning out in the air, but when we have to move learning, you have to know how to do that. I've considered myself a very good teacher, but I have never had a year in all my 20 years in the classroom where I ended the year saying, I did it all for every student. It was done. Good. Perfect. Never. Every year I would go face the summer worried about one or two of my students, really worried about what was going to happen to them the following year. And then I would try to do everything I could to help the teachers that I knew they were going to have to fill in the gaps that I knew I wasn't able to do. And at some point, in the middle of my career, I thought, oh, my gosh, does this mean I'm not a good teacher? No, it meant I was a really good teacher. I was able to reflect on what I was able to do and not do and build. And I think that young teachers are going to sadly not have the ability to do that, and they need to. Children, even in small classes, are children, and they all are different, and you have to have the ability to move their learning wherever they are. And that's what we're going to lose if we don't pay attention to class size. Is it the only thing? Absolutely not. But it is a critical piece. And all the other things have to go in place. And fundamental to that is the funding to do it all. But I think we also have to get back to local school choices around what that looks like. But I think the state, our policies and our funding have to be guided by what we know good teaching and good schools look like. QEM says it all, but we need to wrap our heads around what that looks like in terms of policy and guidance.
And just to chime in on that before I get to you, Representative, I think something that is missing from this conversation is the lack of consistency that we've seen, at least in some school districts, particularly my school district, with regards to class size. It hasn't been consistent for a teacher to say, I'm going to get 32 students this year, or I'm going to get 28, 25. And that has created instability for our students. And I'm not going to defend my school district for its poor performance in terms of the assessments scores and the disproportionality and how it impacts students of color and other marginalized students. But I think moving towards ESSA, more comprehensive way of looking at assessment, how do we actually look at the student and where they're at and their capacity rather than a score itself. I think that shift from our old system of No Child Left Behind Act and the boxes they created around writing and math and reading and this new system that hopefully will build more of a comprehensive education and allow us to assess in a well-rounded way. It's going to open up even, you know, probably a lot more questions as to what we still have to do. And I do think the answer will still be we still need lower class sizes. We still need that stability and consistency. And some of those things always come back to resources, because if my school district had more resources, we would hire more teachers, lower class sizes, build new facilities so that we can fit it. But in order to do that, we do need more resources. It's not that money is the solution. It's how
how do you get to a quality education? And we know the steps to that, and that what does that take? That takes more resources. That's just a comment. Did you want to?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind. You know, there's an old saying that those who say money can't buy happiness simply don't know where to shop. Lori Wimmergan. I think one of the things about the quality education model that gets overlooked is that it does exactly what you just said, Mr. Chair. It identifies the best practices in terms of a range of high-quality inputs that enable schools to meet students where they are and deliver on those results in a well-rounded way. People dismiss the quality education model, in my experience of 21 years doing this work, because they get sticker shock. Because this is not a cheap enterprise. If you're hiring high-quality professionals and attracting them to the profession, and we do have teaching shortages across the board, then it is not an enterprise that you can do, on the cheap. And so the quality education model does reflect not only the best practices, but the cost of those best practices if one were to optimize their educational planning and programming. So as we look at that, class size is one of those fundamental pieces, as is full-day kindergarten and a number of other pieces. But and that's all I wanted to say, is that we do know what works.
Thank you. Representative Evans?
Yeah, thank you. First of all, I want to start off with, if anybody thinks that speech classes in school aren't important, they didn't listen to Representative McLean. She is the exact kind of teacher we need more of. So, again, keeping with what I said earlier, what I believe interim committees are for is to kind of tell you what we're thinking and listen and learn. So I've listened and learned, and here's what I'm thinking. And since everybody in the room that would need to be in the room is here, here's the little grenade to get things going. I believe that we are in a crisis. I believe that we also have a Faustian choice of allowing lesser qualified teachers sometimes taking class loads that are almost impossible for experienced teachers, much less inexperienced, and then we're surprised when teachers last 2 or 3 years and decide they want to go do something sane, like fight wars. Mm-hmm. So here's what I think we need to do, and I'm going to throw it out there as a proposal and ask for anybody who wants to sit at the table and try to figure out a way to do this. We did this with nurses, we did it with cops. What if, instead of trying to solve everything right now, what if we had a 10-year trial period and created something called a teacher associate, where we hire back former teachers that are on PERS but not more than half time, as not teachers and not teacher assistants, but actually teacher associates, helping with the process to get that contact time of a student and somebody who's qualified a little closer to where we want. And we do it on a 10-year clock, so it's not permanently upending the workforce. And it's using folks who have spent their career and have an understanding of how to teach, again, on a voluntary basis. Sometimes, in our attempt to try to do right by people, we build systems that make it hard to actually help when they want to help. And I believe that there are a number of teachers right now that don't want to go back to work full-time, but wouldn't mind giving 10 or 15 hours a week if they thought it would matter and if they thought it was aligned to long-term goals. So that's what I'm going to ask us to do. Just a thought, because I do believe class size is a major issue. I teach every day in community colleges that have students that did not have great one-on-one attention, and I got to clean up the mess. So I think class size is important. Second piece, though, we can't break the bank because we do have constrained resources. Third piece is we have a lot of young retired folks with time and experience. And I think that's a horrible waste if we have obstacles to them actually reinvesting in their community. Mm-hmm. So I want us to look at that in the future. Just a thought.
Thank you. Representative Vile?
I'm going to follow up with another hand grenade, because I think the comments that Representative Evans just made can be boiled down to something that I've been thinking about a lot over the last year. And that is the function of our unions as it relates to the quality of our schools. I am a big advocate for collective bargaining. I believe labor has a right to work together to make sure that their needs are met. But I really feel like, having been a school board member, having negotiated contracts, I really feel like that we have tipped. And it's mostly because of lawyers, those really knuckleheads that are causing all sorts of problems.
We have any knuckleheads in the room?
That's a synonymous term, just so you know. But the reality is, we are so afraid of dealing with poor teachers that we continue to have a lot of them in our system. We are so afraid of using things like what Representative Evans just talked about, using part-timers instead of filling all those jobs with full-timers. Part-timers who in many cases would be much more qualified. I believe we've got to look really critically at how our current system of labor practices as it relates to our teachers is functioning vis-a-vis our students. And so there's the hand grenade. It's a big one, but I'm tossing it.
Look at Senate Bill 290.
Oh, we're just having such a lovely time. Just one more comment.
Yes, we'll do one more question.
My dentist gets paid $2,800 for 2 hours worth of work. So let's be real here, and let's look at what teachers get paid, and let's look at their package of you know, I guess I would call it your fringe benefits too. Let's put that in there too. Let's look at the retirement that they get, all of these different things. But let's be real. You know, there's going to be time for volunteerism, and I agree with that. There's going to be time with using your experts who have done, you know, more in the classroom for a longer period of time and maybe being mentors for younger teachers as well. But there's got to be a real comment here about how much do we care about quality education? Because like everything else, it's going to be what we put into it, whether it be the type of teacher, whether it be the type of salary, whether it be the retention, whatever it is. If we care about our kids and care about our educational system, then we've got to be willing to invest. So that's all. And I'm not saying anybody who spoke today didn't agree with that. I'm just saying it's a little more difficult than a one simple system.
Oh, yeah. And Representative
Vlad.
Thank you. Representative McLean, I couldn't agree more. I would much rather hire a lawyer at $400 an hour that gets the job done than I would to go to somebody at $150 an hour that's never going to get me where I need to go. So I'm not disagreeing with you at all on that.
All right. Any closing remarks? All right. We're going to close the informational hearing. For this next part, I'm going to open the informational hearing summarizing enacted legislation from last session that originated in the House Education Committee. And Pia Miller will lead us through that.
Yeah, Chair Hernandez, members of the committee. So I'm Alethea Miller. I'm the analyst. So there was a request from Representative Doherty that the committee members just receive a brief overview of the bills that were enacted last session, since there have been some questions before, and whether or not there were any additional changes or amendments that happened after the bill left their committee. So just a brief summary, there were 103 bills that were referred to the House Education Committee. 95 of those bills actually originated in the committee, and 47 of them were voted out, and only 20 of those were enrolled into law, and 5 bills had amendments after leaving the House Education Committee. So I'll start just by giving you a quick overview of the task forces, advisory groups, or studies that passed. There were 4 of them. The first one was House Bill 2845B, which directed the Department of Education to convene a statewide ethnic studies advisory group. So this bill was amended in Ways and Means after leaving our committee, and that bill was amended to add an appropriation of $43,000, actually a little over $43,000. House Bill 3216 directed the Chief Education Office to conduct a study to identify students in poverty families. Mm-hmm. And House Bill 3358 directed the Department of Education to convene an advisory group related to English language learners. And House Bill 3412 establishes the task force on the assessment of children who are deaf or hard of hearing. Next, I'll go over 3 bills that related to changes in district and charter school education requirements. First one was House Bill 2219, which was also paired with House Bill 2229, which are Representative Wisnitz bills, which encourage districts and charter schools to offer students courses or educational opportunities in civics and financial literacy. There was an amendment to House Bill 2229 to line it up with 2219, and that was to resolve the conflict so that both bills would start for the 2018-19 school year. And then House Bill 3267 directs districts and charter schools to waive high school diploma requirements not established in state law for foster children, homeless, and runaways. This bill was amended afterwards. This was Representative Viles' bill and Representative Bynum. And this bill was amended to include children in military families, children of migrant workers, and children enrolled in the Youth Corrections Education Program or Juvenile Detention Education Program. So next I'll describe four bills that relate to admission and attendance. House Bill 2997, which was Representative Greg Smith's bill, which revises the distribution of fines for chronic absenteeism to have half sent to the district and the other half sent to the court. House Bill 3029, which was sponsored by Representative Hayden, which allows children to be delayed in school for up to 1 year if they demonstrate a need for cognitive, social, or physical development. And House Bill 3313, which allows charter schools to grant authority to give priority admission to students who reside within the service boundaries of a public school that closed. And that was Representative Mike McLean and Representative Esquil. And House Bill 3409 exempts children from compulsory school attendance who are present on a non-immigrant visa and attend an accredited private English language learner program, which was Representative Evans' bill. And then there were two bills that passed that directly relate to TSVC and teacher certification. This was House Bill 2763, which authorized the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to disburse monies from the National Board Certification Fund for reimbursement of certification costs for teachers. This was amended in Ways and Means to appropriate $1,700,000, and it did only allow TSPC to use up to 10% of the money received during the biennium on administrative costs. And that bill was sponsored by multiple people, but it was presented by Representative Smith Warner and Representative Wisnett before the committee. And House Bill 3351 directs the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to prepare an annual report on their duties, powers, and functions. And that was sponsored by Representative Johnson. And there were three bills that alter or impose programmatic requirements for the Department of Education. So both of the bills that the Department of Education proposed passed. House Bill 2257, which allows the Department of Education to waive the fee for instructional materials that are being reviewed by the State Board of Education if they're open educational resources. And House Bill 2258, which expands the entities allowed to receive funding to nonprofit organizations for CTE. And House Bill 3340, which was sponsored by Representative Hurd and Representative Gorsuch, which requires ODE to provide materials on apprenticeship opportunities available in Oregon to high schools. And there was one bill related to Measure 98 that became enrolled that really altered the statute. And that was 2246, which the House Education Committee had a work group on, and it was convened by the Speaker of the House. And that altered the categories that districts were required to spend the money in. So that was dependent on the amount of money that districts received. Representative Wilson, Representative McLean were on that work group. And then there were two other bills that passed and one resolution. 2648, which was Representative Doherty's bill, which adds school social workers to the list of qualifying professions that districts can use to receive money for decreasing absenteeism. And 3318, which was Senator Gelser's bill, which requires districts to conduct functional behavioral analysis to develop behavior intervention plans. And there was an amendment after it left our committee just to update the definitions and to remove the emergency clause. And it also and it also made it so that districts were required to respond within 45 days of receiving parental consent. And last but not least, there was a resolution by Representative McLean, Resolution 18, which recognizes National Speech and Debate Day.
Okay.
teachers are kids. Is there any questions?
Excellent summary.
Good job.
Thank you.
Good job, House Education Committee. All right. I'm gonna close the informational meeting unless there's any questions. All right, let's close the informational hearing, and that we were pretty efficient in time. With that, we'll adjourn.